Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to September's Small Animal Practice Club webinar. I'm delighted to introduce to you our speaker for today, Canine Behaviour Counsellor Stephanie Hedges. Thank you, Stephanie. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hi, thank you, Sammy, and thank you for everybody for coming. So today we're going to talk about a topic which is going to become very topical very soon, which is sound phobias and problems that animals have with reacting to sound. Obviously, with the fireworks season approaching, there's no doubt something you'll be asked about quite a lot. So today we're going to look at what causes them, what we can do to prevent them, how we can manage them, and also how we can try to reduce the dog's or cat's fear in future years. So first of all, how common are noise phobias? Well, in research, there's been a suggestion that up to 50% of dogs are showing one or more signs of fear during firework events. So these are people who are just generally questioned about their dog's behaviour, and so it seems it's quite common for dogs to feel uncomfortable with the sounds of fireworks, etc. We don't have statistics in cats, or those that we do tend to suggest is a lower frequency. However, this may well be more of a case of the fact that they don't notice. Cats tend to withdraw and hide, so it may be that the owners don't really notice that the cat is fearful, rather than the fact that the cats aren't really bothered by it. Why is there such a sensitivity then if this problem is so common? Well, there is a primal link between sound and the fear centres in the brain. And this is particularly strong in dogs and cats that rely more on sound and smell for identifying a situation that might be threatening than we tend to rely more on what we can see. It's an evolutionary thing that makes sure that the animal is very conscious of noises, and they're able to evaluate whether or not a particular noise is a threat to them. So they are much more sensitive to noise, so that they, as I say, they can identify these noises. And then if they hear a noise that they don't feel they can identify the source of, or they can't verify isn't actually a threat to them, then we tend to get a fight or flight response. We also have to be aware that in some dogs, this sensitivity has been particularly intensified. And here we've got one of these lovely videos of watching border collies working. But I think what's of particular interest is you notice how sensitive this dog is to subtle changes in the whistle.
Right there. Now, I put her down there because I knew if I put her down there, these sheep would stop before the fence. That's a safe distance.
Okay, so you can see in that how subtle the differences are in the whistle commands that the shepherd is using. And that just kind of is an indication, really, of how with border collies we have intensified their response to noises so that they can pick up these very subtle cues. But that, of course, tends to spread into other things, so therefore they're much more likely to be reactive to other noises as well. So it's a natural response, basically, to any sudden unpredictable sound from a source they can't identify, the source that they can't identify, basically. So fireworks, thunder and gunshot are very common ones, but it can be any kind of noise that they can't really identify. And as we're saying, this is a natural response, it's evolutionary, and the problem is arising simply because they can't work out that these noises won't actually hurt them. Whereas we know, because we know what it is, and so we know that it isn't actually a direct danger to us. If we didn't, then I think we probably would have a similar response. And in fact, there was a moment where I think I can very much relate to how dogs and cats feel when I was basically my office is in the middle of the countryside. There's often shooting around me. I don't get particularly bothered by the noise. I'm not scared by the noise. But there was one day when I was sitting there and this noise sounded extremely close. Now, I still knew it was gunshot, but it wasn't in the distance. This was extremely close, or it felt like it was extremely close. in hindsight, I think it was echoing up the valley because I'm next to a river. But for a moment there, I had a really kind of innate fear response and, you know, found myself heart racing and shaking a little bit and expecting to see a man with a shotgun walking in front of my window any moment. So, you know, that was my response really to, I can hear gunshot. And at that point, I didn't feel I could be confident that it was something I didn't need to be worried about. It's just the guys, you know, they're on their farms or whatever. So I suppose that is how the animals feel when they hear it, because they don't know. It can then be aggravated by other things that may be naturally stressful. So flashing lights can be worrying to some dogs, vibration, static, that, you know, you can sense the static, or they can sense the static certainly. So these may all be further things that they can't really happily identify as something that isn't a genuine threat to them. Or of course, something that actually is a genuine threat to them. So if there's a noise and there is actually something that is potentially harmful, this is going to aggravate their response. There are also other factors that can make it more likely that an animal will react. So if there's been poor habituation to sounds and or new experiences, which I will talk about more in a few minutes, exactly what I mean by that, but basically where this is something that the animal hasn't encountered before and so hasn't had the opportunity to learn isn't a problem. We're much more likely to see this if the dog is a generally, or cat is a generally anxious or fearful animal. Or if there's a learnt link between sounds and something unpleasant happening. So if there has been a genuinely unpleasant experience, perhaps an animal was close to a firework when it went off or something like this happened, then obviously they're going to be particularly sensitive to those noises. There is an element of comorbidity. We particularly notice that dogs that have separation anxiety also often have noise phobias. It's a little bit of a case of chicken or egg, really. So it has the dog become fearful of being left alone because it's experienced noises that make it afraid when it's on its own. So it started to become naturally fearful of something bad happening whilst the owner is out, creating a separation distress. Or did the noise phobia come first and then the separation distress occurs because the animal feels they need the owner around in case there's noises. And then when they're out, they get more worried. So they it can be either can start and the other one can follow. There's no necessarily a link between fear of fireworks and other sudden sounds and general phobia, unless the dog has a propensity that way, if that makes sense. So a dog can be fearful, or a cat can be fearful of sounds without necessarily being fearful of other things. But if they are a generally fearful individual, then obviously they're more prone to sound phobia. And then these sort of behaviours tend to escalate over time. And to be honest, the vast majority of cases I see tend to follow a pattern. They've asked me to come and help, usually when the dog is a number of years down the line, and they will usually say, oh, well, he's never really liked them, but he seemed to cope. And then it was as time went by that each year it's got worse and worse. One of the reasons for this, and the most common reason, is what we call self-reinforcement. Basically, fear is a naturally unpleasant emotion. That's its purpose. It's the body's way of saying, get out of this situation, by making it you feel uncomfortable. And you know, I'm sure everybody has a fear of something, and you'll all have experienced fear sensations and the, you know, the feeling sick and the clammy hands and all of those sort of things. And they are how nature makes you try to avoid being in a situation that's potentially dangerous. Now, the risk is that because that sensation is in itself unpleasant, if the animal is exposed to the fireworks and they feel the doggy equivalent of the things that we know we feel, that then creates an association that hearing banging noises always makes you feel awful and scared. And therefore, the next time you hear banging noises, or they hear banging noises, they will immediately start to feel scared just in anticipation of those unpleasant sensations. So it becomes a vicious circle. It can also be made worse if they are prevented from doing what comes naturally to them to try and avoid the trigger. So if they're prevented from hiding or trying to get away from the trigger, or if they're given a perhaps a medication that sedates them but doesn't reduce anxiety. And again, we'll talk more about these as we go along. But these can make the fear more intense because they feel they can't manage it and therefore make them more fearful year on year. There's also a tendency for these sort of things to spread. So again, very often I will hear tales that it started with a fear perhaps of fireworks and has then spread to others. And this can be obviously other noises such as thunder or gunshot, but it can also be banging doors, popping a crisp packet. You know, they can become any everyday noise that has any link to the fireworks or the noises that set this phobia in motion. And it can go from things that the dog can't identify, so there's this distant bang, to things where they can even see where it's coming from, but because of the link between that sound and the fear that they feel, the fear takes over, then the irrational thought of where it comes from is no longer helping. I've also known with hissing, I had one dog that used to become very fearful when the owners put on a roast pork joint, which I'm confident was because when they first started to try and make the crackling, it made these hissing, popping noises, which would have been very similar to fireworks, and the poor dog would hide upstairs and refuse to come downstairs for 2 days after they tried to do this, so they basically had to stop cooking pork for a while. It can spread to locations or other associated triggers. So I've known dogs particularly that won't go to particular places where they've experienced unpleasant sounds, or that suddenly won't start refusing to go for walks, etc. in autumn. And say, you know, it can lead to this kind of agoraphobia where the dog is refusing to go out of the house or refusing to go in a particular direction that they've associated with these noises, but are fine once you take them somewhere completely else. Very commonly, they will get in the car and go to a completely neutral place. But if you try to walk them where they're expecting noises to occur, they won't go. So it's the sort of thing that generally I get consulted at when it's a long way down the line, but actually it would be far better and far easier to treat it if we were consulted as soon as the problem started to show, so that it could be addressed before it escalates in this way. So prevention, what can we do? Well, actually, there's quite a lot that can be done to try and prevent the problem behavior developing. And this is something that can be done in practice. Basically, what we're talking about is habituating the animal. So what is habituation? This is a process whereby the animal identifies a particular stimulus, in this case a noise, and decides it's safe or it's not important. It then reduces the neural firing in response to that trigger, so the brain no longer recognizes and responds to it. This happens naturally. It happens in everyday life all the time. So I often go to other people's houses and I'm sitting and I will notice things like they have a very noisy grandfather clock, or the one that always gets me is those sort of air freshener things that just go off randomly every 10 minutes or so. And I can see that the owner is just not recognizing these noises because they've habituated to them. Their brain has told them this noise is irrelevant, ignore it. But to me, because they're new to me, I'm in a different environment, I'm very conscious of them, and they tend to disturb my flow of thought until I get used to them. Often I've kind of got used to them by the end of the consult, but initially I'm very conscious of them. So habituation is just getting used to something. Animals, including ourselves and puppies and kittens, have particularly sensitive periods for habituation. So habituation can happen lifelong, but they are particularly sensitive to it during very early development. And this is because they're learning very quickly the sounds that are no harm to them. It's linked to the time when they would either be in the den or the nest, or just exploring outside and able to run back into the den or nest very easily. And so most of the things that they are exposed to are safe. And so they basically tend to accept most of these noises, providing they're not strong, really strong, or linked to anything unpleasant, as must be a safe part of life. During this period, they also learn how to cope proportionately with novelty. So whilst We can expose them to all sorts of experiences during this sensitive period. It's pretty much impossible to expose them to absolutely everything they could possibly experience in life. But providing they've had lots of different experiences in a balanced way, then they will learn how to cope with new things, and they will learn how to balance the natural drives of curiosity, which makes us get out of bed in the morning and go and do things, and caution, which balances the curiosity to make sure we don't do things that are really dangerous. And so they're developing a natural balance of curiosity and caution during this period. Dogs are most sensitive to sound at around between about 4 weeks and 8 weeks, and then that will start to fade until this heightened ability closes at 12 to 13 weeks. Now, they can still habituate after this period, but it's much easier before, and the more habituation we can make sure occurs in a positive way during that 4 to 8 weeks particularly, and up to 12 weeks where the owner doesn't have control over the first 4 weeks, the easier it will be. Cats have a much narrower sensitive period, so it starts at 2 to 3 weeks and closes at about 7 weeks, so we really are reliant on the breeder for this. And you know, the fact that these sensitive periods are generally before the animals come to live with owners is why we're always trying to push for them to choose good breeders who will be doing some of this habituation work before the animal comes to us. So we need to expose them during this period in a positive way, so that they learn that banging noises are nothing to be worried about, and also obviously so make sure that they learn to cope. It is very much a balancing act, because a complete lack of stressors of any kind means they'll never learn how to cope. So we can't say, you know, they must not be exposed to these things in case they find it slightly stressful. But if it's too stressful, if the noises are very strong, or they become linked to some kind of fear, such as being trapped, then they may sensitize to the noise, and then that can make the fear worse later in life. So it is very much a juggling act, and we find that the learning that occurs during this first 12 weeks or so, it's very hard to overcome. I won't say you can't, but it's whilst the brain is developing, and it develops very strong neural pathways that tend to dictate behaviour for the rest of the animal's life. So getting it right at this age is really critical. What do we do? Well, first of all, it depends whether or not the animal's going to be exposed to these natural things, or these things naturally, during their sensitive period. If a puppy is born in end of September, early October, or a kitten, same sort of time, then they are going to be exposed naturally to fireworks. Or if they live out in the countryside, they may be exposed naturally to gunshot. Thunder in this country is a bit hit and miss. We never really know when that's likely to happen. But that, you know, there are possibilities depending on where the dog or cat is during that very early developmental period, whether or not they will experience them. If they do experience them naturally, then just making sure that they can cope will enable them to experience it in a positive way and learn there's nothing to be worried about. One of the most important things here is that they can escape. And say, naturally, if they were feral, they would be in some sort of area where they've been born, and they would be during this period just starting to explore within the nest and possibly exploring outside, but they can get back into it quickly. We call this escape to safety. Something bad happens, they run back into the nest, they feel safe, they feel that isn't a scary thing. So ensuring that the animal can escape from the noise is very important. If these noises aren't likely to happen, then mild artificial triggers will help, and this is where sound come in. I'll talk more about where you can get sound scary noises from a little bit later, but yeah, being able to just put these noises on in a gentle way in the background will expose those animals that won't get them naturally and help them to learn. It's very important when this is happening that the owner is observing, or the breeder is observing, the animals' responses very carefully. If they seem to be fearful, they should either stop the recordings or they should drown out the noise and get some help. It's important, as I say, at this point that they're exposed, but not to a point where they're going to become actually sensitized. So in order to do that, they need to be able to read the signs of fear or stress. So I'll just run through these. In dogs, we have signs of fear. So these are kind of physiological signs of fear. You get things like hypersalivation, you get panting, you get yawning, you get hair shedding. They may go off their food. Others include whale eye. So this is where the dog's expression means they're exposing some of the white of their eye, or some people call that half moon eye. They may furrow their brow. They may shake like a wet dog shake, as if they're shaking off moisture. They may whine or vocalize in some sort of way. They may be very clingy or attention seeking. They may be very watchful. We call it hypervigilant. They may be restless. We get things like licking their lips or nose, and we get things like chomping. And I'll just show this little video where you can see this. This is a classic example of behaviorist makes poor dog show signs of stress by getting their son to hug it, just so that poor behaviorist dogs get this all the time, just so that we can demonstrate what we're talking about. So you can see the yawn there. You can see the licking of the lips. Just in slow motion so you can see it. See the narrowed eyes and the furrowed brow. A big yawn. So as I say, I'm sure that person who took that video, which is from the internet, has told their son to hug the dog so that they can demonstrate it. We also get the more obvious things that you're probably more aware of, so things like cowering, tucking the tail, lowering the head, the ears going back, the hackles up. So we'll just show this video. I probably won't show all of it because it's quite long, but you can see some of these signs. So in this situation, we've got a dog that's fearful of the way that it knows it's going to be handled. But you would see very similar signs if a dog was fearful of noises, etc. So you can see it's narrowing its eyes, it's backing away. The equivalent in noise phobia would be trying to hide. Furrowed brow there, lowering the head, sniffing the ground, trying to turn away. So you get the idea. I'm going to stop that there just because I'm already running out of time. So let's find the right button. Obviously at higher levels you'd also get things like the dog trying to hide or trying to escape. You'll get them panicking around windows. I've heard stories of dogs jumping out of even first story windows just in the panic of trying to get away. They may just freeze, they may wee or poo. Sometimes you get defensive aggression. The reports I've had of this most commonly are where people try to physically stop them doing something. So if they're physically trying to calm the dog down or they're physically trying to prevent it from jumping out of a window or whatever, then the dog may behave defensively, aggressively. We also see compulsive behaviours, which is where the dog behaves in a repetitive fashion to try and alleviate their distress. Cats, the signs are much less obvious, which is why I think quite often people don't realise that the cat is distressed, but you get inappropriate urination or defecation, which may include indoor spraying. You can get excessive grooming or under-grooming. You can get under- or overeating. A lot of facial rubbing, which is where they're trying to mark things as safe due to their anxiety and marking out a safe space for them. You might get cats that just sleep excessively or seem to be sleeping, that won't play, that are either very attention-seeking or withdraw completely and tend to hide. Chewing fabric is a thing that cats often do when they're distressed, or just generally changes in everyday behaviour, so things like spending more time indoors than they normally would do. Again, you can get the defensive or redirected aggression, hypervigilance, spooking, so reacting strongly to sounds or hiding. So the owner, if they are, or the breeder, if they are seeing these signs when trying to habituate their puppy or kitten, then they should stop treatment. If they are seeing these signs during natural incidents, then they are best to get some help as soon as possible, purely because the sooner the help is brought in, the better the prognosis. The longer it goes on, the harder it is. The easiest place to find somebody who's appropriately qualified to do this is the Animal Behaviour and Training Council. This is an umbrella organisation for the accredited organisations that check the qualifications and experience and professional conduct of trainers and behaviourists. So that's the place to go to, really, if you're looking for some help. So managing. Basically, if we want to try and treat this problem, we need to wait until we're not expecting any natural events to occur. So we can't do it during the fireworks season or during shooting season if somebody lives that way, or they may have to avoid taking them to places where noises will naturally occur, because we need to control, to teach the animal not to be worried, we need to control the intensity of the trigger. So it means that we can't really start training until we're out of firework or appropriate season. So now really it's too late. We're going to have to be giving advice on management and then looking at treatment once the imminent firework season is over. What do we do? Well, I've kind of come up with my five D's. DAP, this is a cheat. I'm going to explain more in a moment. But it's DAP, then drowning out, distract, and drugs. And those are the five things that we do to try and manage the behaviour. DAP, DAP was the old name for Adaptil. And I came up with my nice little five D's when it was still called DAP, and then they went and changed it. But anyway, it's still a reminder, isn't it? So Adaptil is the dog pheromone and Feliway is the cat pheromone. What are pheromones, for those of you that haven't come across them? Basically, they're a type of semiochemical, i.e. a chemical that carries messages that triggers a physiological or a behavioural response. They are species specific, so cat ones only affect cats, dog ones only affect dogs, and none of them affect us. And so they only affect the own conspecific, is the others of the same species. And these are innate responses. And what we get is a Flemmen response. So you'll see here, this is a video of a cat demonstrating this response. It's sniffing the pheromone and then it's opening its mouth and absorbing that pheromone into the organ on the roof of its mouth, which I'll show you about it, show you in a minute. So it's a much more obvious thing in cats. You do sometimes see this response in dogs. But it's, as I say, you're more likely to see it in cats, and you may have seen it on wildlife programs with things like lions, etc. This again is a video from the internet. It's really difficult to catch this behaviour. So the dog is, the cat here is just reacting to a natural pheromone on that blanket. We don't really know what it is, but we can see the behaviour. So how are these detected? As I say, they're sensed by this vomeronasal organ, which is in the roof of the mouth, or sometimes referred to as the Jacobson's organ. And this then passes the pheromone into the organ on the roof of the mouth that has the effect on the animal's behaviour. There are many of these that affect lots of different behaviours. So the ones we're interested in is where they give the animal a sense of calm or reduce anxiety, etc. But there are lots of others linked to reproduction and all sorts of things. Synthetic analogues, the Adaptil and the Feliway are synthetic versions, i.e. they have created products that have proteins in them that have the same function as the natural pheromones that are seen in the animals. And they're said to have the same effect. And we can use these for behaviour management. So if we look first of all at Adaptil, which is from Siva Animal Health, this one mimics appeasing pheromones or appeasines. And these are produced from the lactating bitch from about 3 days post-parturition, purely to reassure the offspring. It gives them a sense of safety and reassurance whilst they're nursing. And the research has suggested that these effects can persist in the adult. They are also thought to be found in the ear, and which is why dogs seem to have such a thing about sniffing ears. They are supposed to reduce signs of fear or anxiety, increase familiarity and sensitivity, and can also accelerate the desensitization and counter-conditioning process. It comes in a number of presentations. The diffuser is the one that's most suited to fireworks, as we'll be talking about a den in a moment, but you can plug this in close to a nice safe space for the animal or for the dog, and that hopefully will help them feel much more relaxed and calmer in that sort of situation. You can also support this as a supplement with a spray on a bandana. So the idea is you spray the adaptyl spray onto the bandana, let that evaporate for about 10 minutes, and then put that around the dog's neck. Or you could also use the collar as a supplement. The bandana and the collar are particularly useful in cases of agoraphobia, because although the diffuser is great for creating a nice safe space around the den, obviously it's not with them if you're trying to take them out for walks, etc. And so that's where the bandana with the spray or the collar are particularly useful. And as I say, fearful behaviours in 30 dogs with established fear of fireworks showed significant reduction following introduction of an adaptyl diffuser. So, and there's lots of papers on this actually showing that quite a few animals are helped by this. It doesn't solve the problem on its own, and most of the time when I've got feedback from people saying they didn't think it did much was because they just plugged this in and thought that's all they needed to do. It is a supportive therapy, but I have had lots of feedback from people who are using it properly, and the research also suggests that it is helpful in a lot of cases. The idea is that you start 2 weeks before the anticipated trigger and keep it going for 2 weeks after. This is just to make sure that it is in place before and continues to be in place throughout the season, because they often start before people think they're going to and carry on for longer than they expect them to. And particularly if the adaptyl isn't in place before they start, its effect is massively reduced. Because the stress has already started to increase. It takes about a day for the diffuser to work, so it must be switched on all the time. That's just how long it takes to reach the required concentration in the environment. It's also important to keep in mind that it will be lost through open doors and windows, so it needs to be sighted somewhere where it can build up in the environment. The collar doesn't take as long, but again, it does take a while, so the idea is it's kept on all the time. Also, once it's out of the packet, it's starting to lose its effect, and so it's pointless taking it off anyway. It's not going to last any longer. The bandana, as I say, is put on immediately prior to the event, but you need to allow the alcohol that is carried in to dissipate before you put the bandana around the dog's neck, which is why you perhaps spray it on for about 10 minutes before and then allow it to dissipate before putting it on. And then with cats, we have Fellaway. This is based on feline facial pheromones. And apesines excreted by the apocrine glands in the perioral area and cheeks of the cat. The one that's recommended for fireworks is the feline facial pheromones 3, which is in Fellaway. This one, again, is something that marks an area as safe. So this is when cats are rubbing themselves on things. This is what they're trying to do, is to put these pheromones on to say it's a safe place. And so by using the diffuser for the environment, then you can mark areas and spray on certain surfaces to help the cat feel that a particular place is safe. Again, you need to use similar sort of techniques as with the dog, and you need to make sure that the area you're using it on is actually a safe space for them. So, talking of safe spaces, we also create them a den. And this mimics the escape to safety I was talking about earlier. So if a young puppy or kitten experiences something that scares them in the environment, then their natural response when they're very young would be to run into their den. And so what we're trying to do is create a den that is safe for them. We need to get this set up before the trigger is likely to occur, and to encourage them to like it. So we put nice things in there and encourage them to like it and to be wanting to go in there before the fireworks or whatever else starts, simply because that then becomes their instinctive place to go when they become scared. If we don't establish it before the trigger starts, then they will just see it as another new scary place and won't want to use it necessarily. We need to make sure it's always available, so even if the owner isn't there, the access to the den has to be maintained. It's best in a room with soft furnishings because soft furnishings absorb noise, so that will help, and it's best sited away from windows or external doors. We can soundproof it with padding, so you can put foam or duvets over the top or something to make it absorb noise so that inside it's as soundproof as is possible. Making it cozy, it wants to be the right size that the animal, the bed size, it can lay in there. It doesn't need to have room to move around or water or anything like that because it's never going to be locked in. It's just bed size but three dimensional. Layering blankets often helps, so if you've got three or four blankets in there, they can get underneath them. But obviously we need to make sure that the circulation is maintained, especially with heavy coated individuals. Make sure it's always somewhere nice and desirable. I'm showing lots of different pictures because I find in practice a lot of owners are very reluctant to put something scruffy in their living room or whatever. So, you know, it can be as pretty as they want it to be, it doesn't matter. I find rotating washing blankets helps because that keeps the dog scent without, cat scent without it becoming overpowering. So they have four or five blankets, wash different ones, so we can never smell it, but they can. Something the owner has slept with, toys and treats, lavender oil can sometimes help. So all of these things make it desirable. They should never be confined and it should never be used to punish them. This is a nice, happy, positive place. If the animal won't use the soundproof den, they can be encouraged into a room with lots of soft furnishings to absorb the noise, close curtains, hang quilts over the windows, put on the lights to kind of hide any flashing lights, etc. They can play music with a rhythmic beat so that that tends to, again, drown out some of the noises, or white noise, so this is kind of a kind of hissing noise that they tend to focus on, and it takes the attention away from the banging noises, etc. Important not to do anything the animal finds worrying. It may sound obvious, but you know, if the dog doesn't like the hoover, it's really best to not do the hoovering during the firework event. Otherwise, we end up with the trigger stacking effect, where if there's lots of different things that are worrying the dog, they get to the point where they really can't cope. And obviously not letting them out or taking them out whilst things are going on. Distracting, if they can, if the animal will play or train, that can help, but some are too scared to do so. When it comes to ignoring, again, there's a little bit of a line to be walked. So ignoring is a punishment. I think historically sometimes it's been badly worded. I don't think it was ever intended to say ignore your dog, but there has been literature in the past that's talked about ignoring the dog during the any kind of event, or cats if they're seeking attention, when actually what they mean is ignore the unwanted behavior, if that makes sense, but not ignoring the animal per se. Ignoring, as I say, we use that as a punishment for jumping up and attention seeking behavior. So if the animal thinks I hear fireworks and then my owner starts to ignore me, then that's going to make them even more worried. So what we're aiming to do is rather to just not pay extra attention, not to fuss over them excessively. You can't reward fear. You know, people say you reward the fear. You can't. Fear is involuntary. The dog can't think, oh, I'll feel fearful again tomorrow so that I get some extra attention. But if you're fussing over them too much, it can make them think something odd is going on. And exceptionally, if a dog's a tiny bit scared and they've learnt that fussing you or behaving in a certain way gets extra attention, you could train in attention-seeking behaviour. It's not that you're not training in fear, but you are training in the behaviour. So I would just act as if nothing odd is going on. If the dog wants to come and sit with you or cuddle up with you, or the cat wants to sit on your lap, that's absolutely fine. But your demeanour should be the air hostess that says this turbulence is fine. Everything is fine. There's nothing to be worried about. There are various drugs you can also use. I'm going to run through these a little bit quickly just because, as I say, I'm going to run out of time. I always do too much. But basically, we can use drugs either for short-term management. So there are products that can be used to just help the animal feel better during a firework event. We can use them to re-establish emotional homeostasis. So if a dog has become highly stressed and or a cat has become highly stressed and they're now feeling chronically anxious, we can use drugs to help them get back to a normal sort of emotional state. Or we can use them to artificially adjust their emotional state to help them. So if we've got an animal that is fearful of noises, even at the most tiny distant noise you can possibly create, then it may be that we need to give them some drugs that will help them feel more relaxed and so able to cope. And then we can start doing the training. In short-term management, benzodiazepines are the most commonly used. We've got diazepam or alprazolam. These act on GABA receptors, which are inhibitory and basically help to reduce excitation and anxiety. The motor effects are governed by a different receptor set. So if we get the right dose, we should be able to get an anxiolytic effect without the motor effects, which tend to make them so they, you know, they're falling over, etc. It also inhibits learning due to its effects on glutamate receptors. And so that can actually have quite a good effect on preventing this vicious circle. If we give the drug before, it will stop further learning that banging sounds are linked to feeling afraid. And there's even some suggestion that certainly alprazolam has a retrograde amnesic quality. So even if it's given after the noises have started because they weren't expected, it can still help reduce that learning. But obviously the fact that they can't learn means we can't really use them during desensitization training. We also have to be aware with all of these drugs that disinhibition of behaviour may cause increased aggression. So if the dog has a tendency towards aggression, there is a risk that that will be increased. And there's a risk of paradoxical hyperexcitation. And this is where we get the complete opposite effect to the one that we want. It's rare, but it does happen. And so often it's a good idea to test the dose before using during a real incident to see whether this individual animal is likely to have that effect. We also have to bear in mind that it may trigger tolerance. So the more it's used, if it's used long term, then they need higher and higher doses for that to be effective. And we get a rebound effect if it's suddenly stopped, which is why really it's not ideal to be used other than for short periods. It's not an effective long term product. And then more recently, we have dexmedetomidine, which is not something, something only came out last year, so I haven't got a huge amount of experience of it. I know two people who were given it. One didn't feel it helped, but had great difficulty administering it. The other one did feel it definitely helped. It's an oromucosal gel. It's got a marketing authorization for noise phobia, and it is shown to have anxiolytic effects at subsedative dose. Obviously, at high doses, we use this for sedative, but at a low dose, it does shown to be to reduce anxiety, and early research papers have shown it to be quite effective. There's lower risk of the addictive problems that we were just talking about, or the hyperexcitation we get with benzodiazepines, but it doesn't have the amnesic effect. There is again an increased risk of aggression in dogs that are predisposed that way. I think one of the most important things is to get the owners to start teaching the dog to be happy with the syringe in their mouth before they need to dose them. The lady who really struggled was because her dog was already climbing up the walls when she decided to give it to them, and then she was trying to put the syringe in its mouth and it just really didn't work. So they need to get the dog familiar with the syringe so that doesn't just add to the anxiety of the situation. The product has to be absorbed through the mucous membranes and not swallowed. They suggest avoid feeding immediately before or after so that we don't get excess saliva diluting it. And the fact that it has to be absorbed through the mucous membrane suggests that it's hard to overdose, because that was one of my concerns. But they've said if they give too much in one dose, it just will end up being swallowed rather than absorbed. And so they can't really overdose it. We also have alpha-casozepine, which is zilkine. This is a milk protein. Again, it's recognized to have calming qualities. It works on the same receptors as benzodiazepines, but obviously doesn't have anywhere near as powerful effect. The effect of alpha-ketoazepine on neonates, i.e. when they drink milk, is because they will digest trypsin over pepsin, and it's the trypsin that helps. And so the kind of relaxed, calming effect of milk is seen in the young, in babies, puppies, kittens all tend to sleep better after they've had a nice milk feed. But in the adult, it doesn't work as well because the adult digestive system prefers pepsin. And so what they've done is basically modified the milk protein so that it can have the desired effect in mature individuals. Basically, in summary, if it's given preventatively, it's given before the animal becomes stressed, then we do see stress reduction within about 24 hours. However, once there's an established stressor, i.e. after the animal's anxiety levels have started to go up, then it takes much, much longer, and very little effect in 14 days. So it needs to be given before things start to go wrong. I think I've just mentioned all of that, haven't I? I'll quickly mention ACP because this has historically been given as a preventative or something for managing noise phobias. I know certainly when I started nursing, it was given very freely by the practice that I worked at. We know it reduces the response to stimulation. It increases arousal thresholds and behavioural thresholds. So it takes more to get a response from them. You get slowed reactions, you get lethargy. However, what you also get is blunted decision making, which can lead to aggression. You get disinhibition of some behaviours. And there is research to suggest that it increases stress and increases noise sensitivity. Increased cortisol levels were seen in cows, where this was used as an example paper. And it's this inability to cope that is thought to create the stronger response. So basically, the animals, because as we said earlier, things like inability to cope by moving away increases fear. If they have been effectively sedated so they can't stand up properly, then that can increase that fear. So it's not recommended anymore. Then our long-acting medications, we've got serotonin and noradrenaline reuptake inhibitors, and we've got selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and we've got monoamine oxidase reuptake inhibitors. They're all a bit of a mouthful, aren't they? Basically, in short, the SSRIs and SNRIs elevate mood, calm animals, reduces aggression. It also improves learning due to increased noradrenaline. So what we're really looking for is that calming and the relaxed, happy sort of feeling, that relaxed, content feeling is what we're looking for, and the reduction in panic. What they do is they increase the amount of serotonin and or noradrenaline by reducing it being taken back up again. So the body produces this stuff and then reabsorbs it back into the terminal bouton in the nervous system. So that it can be recycled, but the drug stops it being taken back up. So that means that each time the nerve produces more, there's a build up in the synapse until we get much higher levels of serotonin and or noradrenaline. It also takes time to increase more receptors so that that higher level of serotonin and noradrenaline can actually be utilized, which is why it takes quite a while to have full effect. And it also helps with things like binding proteins and factors, etc. We have the main one we have in veterinary use is clomipramine or clomicalm, clomipramine, I think the Americans pronounce it. This has a marketing authorization for separation disorders in dogs only. But obviously via the cascade, it can also be used in other problem behaviors in dogs. We also have fluoxetine hydrochloride. Now, this is fluoxetine, which is Prozac in people, is a much stronger drug. It's more selective for serotonin, and so it improves the level of calm and relaxation that we get. It doesn't have a marketing authorization in the UK, so this, again, uses the cascade, but uses it further. It is used by, or it is permitted as a product in Europe, where it has a marketing authorization for separation disorders, again in dogs only, and it's used widely in America. And so by using the cascade to use it as being licensed in Europe and also being licensed for separation disorders, we were using the cascade to use it for a different condition. So it requires you go down further, but it is stronger, and it really, it's the vet's discretion whether or not they want to try clomipramine first or whether they want to go straight to fluoxetine. Personally, I've had much more success with fluoxetine, but I appreciate, you know, that they say it requires further use of the cascade, and so they may want to feel they want to try something else first. Because these products take a couple of months, though, it means, you know, a couple of months of the other drug, and then it can take 6 months before we're seeing whether or not we're getting the desired effect. Monoamine oxidase inhibitors, this is responsible, monoamine oxidase A is responsible for reuptake of serotonin, adrenaline and noradrenaline, and B is responsible for reuptake of histamine and dopamine. Both work on phenethylamine, which I can never pronounce properly. And basically, using the same principle of preventing reuptake, then we can increase dopamine and phenethylamine, which will then increase noradrenaline. And what this does is it improves learning, it reduces, it increases reward chemistry. It's less of a suitable drug for this type of problem because it has less of an effect on the anxiety side of things. It's more for fear that's causing animals to be reluctant to explore, and the curiosity isn't there. So I would generally, personally, see more effect with the SSRIs with this type of problem. But it could be helpful in a case of severe agoraphobia, perhaps, to help them be more willing to, with seeking behaviour, wanting to go forward, wanting to look for things and explore, and learning that everything is good and getting that nice sensation of reward to encourage a repetition of the behaviour. And the particular drug that we're talking about, Celgene or Selegaline, and this is for monoamine oxidase B, and it has a marketing authorization for behaviours of purely emotional origin. So it's it's quite a broad one there, and for helping behaviour modification programs with a partially emotional origin. And it cites particularly overactivity, separation problems, and social behaviour and phobias. So it doesn't require use of the cascade, that would fall into it. I always manage to get dog whispering or dominance hierarchy or something into all of my talks, just because it's such a misunderstood subject. I've snuck it in purely because some may advocate using dog whispering type methods to address phobias, which in this video, I'm not going to show it to you. I think it's quite horrible, but you may want to see it just so you see for yourselves the potential detrimental effect, or to show clients the potential detrimental effect. But in this case, what they basically do is force all these dogs to be exposed to a firework being let off in the middle of them, and the idea being that they would be flooded and overcome their fear. Sadly, that isn't actually what happens in the video, but it's being aware that some people will advocate these methods, and really, you know, they are potentially very dangerous, potentially make dogs much, much worse, and are ethically very highly questionable. So the last little section that I will endeavour to go through is how do we stop it from happening again? What we want to do is really long term, to teach the animal that they don't have anything to be worried about. Now this is very much a quick overview, purely because implementing this type of training really needs some practical experience, so it would be a good idea to speak to local behaviourists, etc., to get a bit of guidance in doing it. But it's worth mentioning because it's an important thing to be able to advise clients or direct them into the resources that are available for them to help their dogs or cats learn not to be worried before the next season comes along. It involves a process called desensitisation and counterconditioning. Desensitization is really where an animal stops being worried by something they've become sensitized to. So as we said earlier, habituation is where they just get used to something that they've previously neutrally, don't really know whether they're worried about it or not. So the ticking clock is just a noise. They get used to that noise over time, and then, you don't pay any attention to it. Desensitization is the same process, but where the animal has become sensitized to the noise, i.e. they hear the firework and they're immediately fearful, and we're going to teach them they don't need to be fearful of it. The idea is that they start with a fearful response, and then with the appropriate exposure, that then becomes a neutral response. They're not scared of it anymore, but equally they don't see it as a positive thing. The next step is the counter conditioning, and this is where we teach the animal to associate the trigger with something that's particularly pleasurable. So what we're effectively doing, the term counter conditioning means we're conditioning it to something else. Instead of the animal being linking the trigger with fear, the firework bang means they're going to feel afraid, we're going to teach them that the firework bang means they're going to have something nice, something that is pleasurable. And so after we've done our desensitization, their response to the banging noise is neutral, and then we change that to positive so that they actually hear the noise and go, yay, great, something nice is going to happen now. We have to bear in mind that none of this erases existing learning. The learning is still there, and so the new conditioned response has to become stronger than the existing learning. So it takes quite a lot of training, but it's a relatively straightforward thing to do, and not even that time consuming, really. We also have to keep in mind that heightened fear affects the animal's ability to learn. So we have to be able to control the intensity of the trigger, and we have to be able to desensitize them to it before we try to counter condition. So what you would find often difficult is playing the noise and just starting doing the nice thing like feeding or playing games or whatever, because in a lot of cases the animal will be too nervous, and that fear would stop them from being able to learn that there's nothing to be worried about. So that's why we have to go through the desensitization part first, so they learn not to be scared, then they learn to like it. We do the second part. We don't just stop at desensitization, because desensitization breaks down very easily, and the counter conditioning is the idea is it will lessen the likelihood that will happen. If they've started to learn that a banging noise is actually something nice, and then there is, say, one particularly very loud bang that even makes the owner jump out of their skin, it's less likely that they'll then go right back to square one, because the quiet noises or the normal noises will still be linked to something pleasurable. So we need both steps. What we do is we make sure the animal isn't going to be exposed to the trigger, first of all. So if I use fireworks as an example, we have to make sure initially that we're doing it at a time when we don't expect any fireworks. We use recordings to control the exposure. So we've got these Sound Scary recordings. These are now available on the Dogs Trust website. If you go to Dogs Trust website and search for Sound Scary or firework sounds, you will find all of these available, and the booklet that explains what to do available for clients to download. You have to make them realistic, and one of the most important things is to make sure that the quality of the sound is right and that it's a realistic pattern. So some recordings that you can get out there are just 5 minutes of bangs and whooshes that are not really very realistic for how things actually happen. The beauty of the Sound Scary is it starts with the least scary thing. So you've got 15 minutes of whistles, then you've got a mixture of whistles and bangs, then you've got 15 minutes of bangs, and then, and this is the most important bit, you've got about 15 minutes of random bangs and then quiet. And that's what they're really like, isn't it? When you're sitting and there's a firework event going off, or your local neighbours are letting the fireworks, it tends to be bang and then a minute of nothing and then another bang. And that's the most realistic sort of effect. So that's why I particularly recommend using these noises, because they've been created to be realistic. I also tend to use remote speakers positioned by windows, etc. I find most dogs and cats get used to the noises that come out of the sound system or come out of the telly or the sound surround, because all sorts of weird noises come out of that when people are watching movies or whatever all the time. And so they have habituated to those noises. They just haven't habituated to the ones that come from outside. And with modern technology, people can download these noises onto their phones, onto their laptops or their tablet or whatever. They have a Bluetooth speaker, and this is hidden behind curtains. It can even be put in the garden. Do check the other neighbours' dogs aren't scared of them as well, otherwise we'll just cure one dog and make the rest worse. They can be put on top of cupboards, they can be moved, they can be taken on a walk. I get people taking them on a walk in their backpacks once we get to that sort of level. So we need to use sort of realistic sound systems. We test the noise, so start at zero and turn it up until you see the very first signs of worry, and then stop immediately. We are testing to make sure the dog is reacting to the noise, and we're working out at what level it can cope. And then start with the least worrying sound, which will usually be the whistles, with the sound at zero. And this time you're turning up just to the point where you see a little ear twitch or a bit of interest, but not fear. No fear. It's important they're not showing signs of fear. And then play it and carry on as if nothing's happening. And I just say to people, you just put this on the background and you carry on doing what you normally do. Read your book, watch the telly, do the cooking. It doesn't matter. Whatever it is that would normally be happening, because what we're trying to say is, this is normal. There's nothing to be worried about. They repeat twice daily. They provide the den. They provide the adaptyl and felly way. They're sure the animal can get away if they are worried by it. And just say, carry on as if nothing is happening. Once they're showing no interest in the noise at all, they then start playing it. And as it plays, they do something fun. They do some treat training. They give some fuss. They give it some treats. They feed it dinner. And they continue that for the duration of the recording. And then as soon as they stop that, they stop the recording. So it starts to become associated. As soon as that noise comes on, it predicts, I'm going to get some fun now. And what they should start to see after repetition is the animal starting to show an interest in the noise in a positive way, and then they can turn it up. We have to be very prescriptive in how they turn it up, because people will often go too far too fast. So I usually say turn it up by 5% and repeat, and then turn it up by another 5% and repeat until they reach normal level. Do a little bit, they do have to be a little bit careful. I had one client who they were doing really well and they said everything was going brilliantly, and then suddenly the dog started to become fearful again. And when we explored it, it's because they had this fantastic sound system. And the husband of the house said, well, the level of noise even made me feel uncomfortable, because they were blaring it out at disco level, which was just too much. And so it needs to be just up to the point where the it's similar to the realistic sounds. And then they stop at that point. They go through all the tracks, and then they can start doing things like playing them in different rooms, outside of the window, in the car, taking it on a walk, all of this sort of thing. So, as I say, that's very much a whistle stop tour. There is an instruction booklet on the Dogs Trust website that goes into a little bit more detail. But one of the best things to do before actually kind of guiding clients in doing this would be to perhaps approach your local ABDC, behaviorist or whatever, and see if you can sit in and observe this happening to make sure you've got the right expertise to guide clients, or obviously making a referral if they feel that the animal shows fear at even the lowest settings, if they're not making any progress within a couple of weeks, or if you just don't really feel comfortable, you don't feel the client's comfortable doing the training, then it may be that you decide to refer to a behaviorist and ask them to advise on what to do. So I've battled through that last bit very quickly, and as I say, it's mainly an introduction. I think in practice the main thing you're going to be able to be advising on is the prevention and the management, but as I say, having a good idea of how we treat it in the long term, it may be something that those who want to study a little bit further can do from the practice, if the dog isn't showing any other, or cat isn't showing any other kind of problem behaviour. I suppose the next thing is whether or not anybody has any questions. Just give people a moment. Okay, so somebody's asked how long the desensitization and counterconditioning takes. To be honest, it's a little bit of how long's a piece of string. Because we are only progressing, i.e. we're only turning up volume or moving to different situations, etc., when the animal is showing no interest in the sounds, and then the counter conditioning, we're only going to the next level when they actually look expecting something nice from the sounds, then it will totally depend on the animal's response. Some will progress quite quickly, whereas others may take much longer. I've had reports of clients that have done the whole thing in about 3-4 weeks, and they've said that when the next firework season came, that, you know, it had worked brilliantly. I've had others that have taken quite a few months, and some where we've had to put them on medication to do the desensitization because their response is so strong to, as soon as they are even vaguely aware of that noise, they go off the scale. And so it very much depends on the individual animal. So yes, anything from 3-4 weeks to 6 months, just depends. And somebody's asked how do we create white noise? And so white noise is just really something that we can use as a way of distracting the animal from the other noises. And there are special white noise machines that you can get, or you can use a fan. That's often quite a good one if that's kind of appropriate to the circumstances. Or you can just use a radio that isn't tuned to a station. It gives off that hissy noise, doesn't it? And that's also another effective way of creating what we call white noise. It's just a constant noise that has no kind of real value to it. It's not a noise of anything in particular. And what it does is it gets the animal's attention onto that and away from the other further distant bangy noises. Okay, I think that's all of them. So thank you very much for listening, and I hope it's been useful.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Stephanie for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.